Welcome back to Dialed Up. It's been a while. In this podcast, we take the biggest problems facing agriculture, dial the volume up, and explore what's being done to fix them. Last season, we talked about America's access to broadband internet. This season, we're diving into something much more nuanced. It's about the earth. It's about dirt. It's about regeneration and sustainability. But it's also about politics, economics, and the future of food in America. This season, we're diving into the economics of sustainable farming. Now, before you exit out of this file and go find your true crime podcast, listen up. Sustainable farming is not as boring as it sounds. And hey, even if it is boring, it directly affects your life. It affects your choices every day. It affects your options for those choices. Not only does agriculture affect what you choose to have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it affects whether you have those things at all. It affects your nutrient intake. It affects our country's economics. It affects global trade. It affects culture. And it affects the ways we interact with one another. Farming affects just about everything we do in the United States, every day, whether you're directly connected to it or not. So, I'd argue, this is a podcast for everyone, not just farmers, not just people interested in sustainable food or in reforming our food systems, though we all should be. Sustainable farming quite literally keeps all of us alive. And beyond that, if we reform our farming systems, we can sequester more carbon, more greenhouse gas emissions. We can quite literally change the trend of our climate. So, yes, this is important to everyone. Understanding how we can support sustainable agriculture is vital to the future of our country and our globe. And whether you grow food or you consume it, you have a role to play in the sustainability of our future. And for that, I think it's important that you learn about sustainable agriculture, about how we can support it, so that you can better support it in your buying choices, in your lobbying choices, in our politics, and in your day-to-day life. All right, let's jump back in. Sustainable farming. It's certainly not a new idea. In fact, it's widely believed that the term was coined in the 1980s by a man named Wes Jackson in a book called New Roots for Agriculture. However, it is a nuanced idea that isn't well understood among those who don't farm. Sustainable farming doesn't just mean organic farming. There's a bucket full of methods farmers can employ to be more sustainable. And yes, that could include organic farming, where farmers eliminate herbicides and pesticides on their fields. However, that could also mean regenerative farming, in which farmers focus more on building soil health so they're not depleting the earth's nutrients. The opportunities for sustainable farming are wide, and they're also based on a farmer's location, their financial resources, the research that's available to them, and the support they receive. But we'll get into that later. Now, without getting too far into the weeds, I think it would be helpful to define some of the practices you'll hear about in this season. You'll hear experts and farmers mention them, and while you don't need to know the details about each practice, it would be helpful for you to have a reference point. Farmers can use a range of methods like cover cropping, no-till farming, optimized inputs, and ag technology to make their efforts more sustainable, less wasteful, and less polluting. Cover crops are plants that farmers plant in their fields when the crops that they're selling, corn, soybeans, wheat, are off-season. These plants help slow erosion, smother weeds, and feed important nutrients into the soil. Often, it's the same nutrients that those cash crops deplete from the soil, so it becomes a healthy system. Tillage farming is a method in which growers disturb the soil after they've harvested their crop to help dig out all the roots from the field. No-till farming, on the other hand, is more sustainable. It means that farmers are not disturbing the land post-harvest. It keeps the soil's integrity, keeps some biomass, or plant goo, in the soil, and helps reduce erosion. Ag technology is any technology that helps farmers farm smarter. There's a lot of technology out there that can help growers plant more efficiently, and if they do choose to use inputs like herbicides, pesticides, or additional nutrients, they're able to optimize their use in only the places that really matter. All right, now it's time for a history lesson. Employing sustainable farming practices is not easy. It's a deviation from the conventional farming we often see driving through the Midwest on our road trips. These rows and rows of single crops in the summer, the disturbed soil after harvest, fallow ground in the off-season, all of that is conventional farming. And it's not bad. We come by it honestly. Back in World War II, the U.S. was under immense pressure to feed the world and with very few people to help do so. percent of the workforce in the U.S. was called into the military during the war, and that put a huge squeeze on farm labor. The only real solution to this problem was to develop machinery that allowed farmers to cover more ground with fewer people. Tractors, irrigation systems, even chemicals that were used in the war were converted to help crops grow faster. In the 1950s, the focus of agriculture was on yield. How much food can we produce and how efficiently can we produce it? It seemed to be the only way to support the world's growing population after the decimation of the war. And in an oversimplified way, that's how we transitioned to big farming. Lots of the same crop being farmed the same way with machinery and chemicals that were created to enhance yield. More food, more quickly. But now, we're in a different kind of war.
Farm production increased tremendously during the war, and so did farm income, up 250% from 1939. Big farms got bigger. It was the beginning of the agribusiness. The small family farmer was beginning to be eased out by the big operators just when he was being lionized as a national folk hero called upon to feed the world.
Farmer save the world.
More beans.
Farmer save the world.
More milk.
More.
More rhubarb.
More.
More spinach.
More.
More grapefruit.
More.
More cabbage.
More.
More grain.
More grain for bread. Grain for life.
Seems to me if I was one of them big fellas in Washington...
We're fighting climate change,
and
with that comes a host of new considerations for farming.
Trying to try
Enter
to figure
sustainable
out
farming practices.
To,
or
the food
re-enter,
all over
I should
thin,
say.
So it'll cover more. See what I mean?
Because I want to reiterate that Americans did not come up with sustainable farming practices.
That's all I can give you.
In fact, this is really a callback to original farming methods. Methods that are better for the soil, the water, and ultimately for people. But anyway, it has become more feasible than it used to be. And farmers are interested in it. Every farmer we've interviewed for this series emphasizes that they want to be good stewards of the land. But here's the big catch. We need to find the best ways to support sustainable farming. Because here's the thing, sustainable farming isn't cheap. In order to transition to sustainable farming practices, you need new tools, new technologies. You
when
need time for your soil to become healthy
old,
again.
I first
time that needs to be logged before you can be certified organic or earn any of the certifications that will
Apparently
make your product
that was
more
something
expensive.
Humans had created
so,
by
for
our way
transitioning
of
farms, there's a big chunk of time
I
where producers are making less food
lights,
in a more painstaking
energy,
way,
and
investing money
paper,
in new technologies
to
and tools
resources.
And seeds, and earning the same profit.
I remember thinking that it was
Add
very
that to the typical market fluctuations for commodities, the fact that weather
species,
can make or break
others,
a year's harvest, and the impact of things like pandemics on our global food supply. By now, you understand
because
the risks.
If we were,
sustainable
if
farming isn't cheap.
We wouldn't
but
be
we
talking
all
about
need
anything
and
else.
Like to eat good food. Nutritious
as
food that isn't
TV,
going to leave us with a desolate
about
planet.
That.
How can we help?
Headlines,
In short, the government could help incentivize some of these practices, and so could private companies. These entities have time and resources and a significant concern for the future of the Earth and its inhabitants.
And
in this season, we'll dive into just two common topics when discussing support for agriculture practices. Long-established programs like crop insurance and flashy new programs like carbon markets. They're two very specific topics, but they'll give a little insight into how we can all support sustainable farming, where the field might take us, and how we can all contribute to that healthier planet. And I mean that in the economic sense, the nutritional sense, and in the environmental sense. As we prepare to dive into this season, I want you to hear from an expert in farming and agribusiness. This is Jolene Hadrich. You may recognize her from season one. Jolene is an agribusiness expert and researcher at the University of Minnesota's Extension Program. We had a long conversation about sustainable farming practices. Here's a little context around sustainable farming, how the agriculture industry is adopting these practices, and some of the high-level barriers farmers are facing when it comes to sustainable farming.
You just have to go on the fly with technology. Like, I've just sort of learned, like, you can't get upset about any of these things. Like, it just sort of happens and you hop back in when you can, and that's life.
I'm hoping you could introduce yourself for us. Let us know a little bit about your background, both with agribusiness and with the Extension Program, and personally, your own agriculture experience.
Yep, more than happy to do so. So thanks for having me be part of this podcast. So my name is Jolene Hadrich, and I am an associate professor and extension specialist at the University of Minnesota. And I work in the area of farm management. So what that means is I use farm-level financial and production data, and I use that to answer questions relevant to ways for the farms to maintain or increase their profitability. And oftentimes, I'm looking at that from an environmental perspective or a market condition perspective. So, you know, if there's a new sustainability goal that farmers are currently trying to implement, we look at ways that they can do that to increase or maintain their current profitability level. And we'll chat a little bit more about that later. So that's my general area. Where I really specialize is with the dairy industry. So I actually grew up on a dairy farm in central Minnesota. So my parents had anywhere between 100 to 150 dairy cows. And growing up, you know, I was responsible for feeding the calves, milking the cows until, you know, I was 18 and went to college. And my parents had that dairy farm until 2018 when they decided to sell the milking herd. But they still have dairy steers, so the male calves they raise out for meat production. So that's a bit about my background and what I do at the university.
And I know we're talking today about sustainable farming practices, and you mentioned sustainable farming practices and profitability for farmers. What is your experience with sustainable farming practices? I know that they've been around for a long time, and there are several different terms that can technically fit under that umbrella: organic farming, regenerative farming. And I also know that some of those have been gaining traction over the last several years. So I'd love to hear what you've heard from farmers, from research, or from your own community about how it's being received in agriculture.
Yes. So I'm going to, you know, start with the dairy example, since that's what I grew up with. And, you know, one of the terms that we use a lot in the dairy industry is talking about being good stewards of the land. And you know, and often when we're looking at dairy, we're looking at making sure that we have vegetative buffers near, you know, local waterways. And that was something that Minnesota really emphasized at a state legislative level. But other, you know, sustainability goals are just looking at how are we conserving water on the dairy operation. Instead of, you know, when we're cleaning like the milk pipelines after we're done milking, we save that water in a bin and we're using that to clean the milking parlor. So we're reusing it. We're not just putting it, you know, down the drain and out into like a local leach field. So from the dairy perspective, those are some of like the farm level sustainability goals that have been happening, you know, long term. But then, you know, more recently, we've had a lot of, you know, corporations and consumers asking questions about what are actual sustainability goals. How do we as consumers make sure we're buying products that are produced in a way that is sustainable for the earth and our environment? And that gets a little bit tricky because I sit on a lot of panels, and most companies and corporations are still trying to define what they mean by the term sustainable. And one of the things that I think is really important is that sustainable is going to be different depending on where a farm is located, because the Western model of dairy production is very different than dairy production you see in the Midwest or the East, where, you know, it rains more frequently, farms are a little bit smaller, they're able to raise their own feedstuffs, whereas in the Western part of the U.S., those dairy farms are significantly larger. And they may have a smaller land base, but they're purchasing that feed from another source. So maybe there's a local crop farmer that's raising that all for them, and then they're bringing it over. So those sustainability goals differ. And then there's also the other side of it, that a sustainability goal for a livestock producer is going to be different than a sustainability goal for a crop producer. And one of the things that I've been working on most recently is looking at the use of cover crops in the Midwest. And what cover crops are is, if you think about the stereotypical cornfield, you would have those rows of corn, but then planted in between those rows of corn would be a cover crop. So most common in the Minnesota is like rye grass. So that cover crop allows weed suppression, so you don't have a lot of weeds popping up, so you can decrease your use of, you know, pesticides or other herbicides for weed suppression, so that crop can grow. But then it also keeps that soil in place. So if there's like a bad wind event, or if we have a lot of rain, which has not been the case this year in Minnesota, but if you would have a lot of rain, those cover crops can pull that moisture down rather than having it just run down that row into a ditch. Jointly, when it's dry, that cover crop also, if you do get a small amount of rain, helps capture that moisture and hopefully distribute it with the root structure to the corn where it's needed.
It's interesting, sort of, as we set the stage for support for sustainable agriculture, it's interesting to remind ourselves of those nuances, regional differences in how people farm and what that means for their definition of sustainability, and then what you're producing if you're raising livestock or if you're raising crops. those things are so nuanced on the farmer's level and on the farm level, but can be, I would imagine, quite difficult for a national company or for a government organization that is responsible for a wide swath of people to define sustainability and then to help support specific actions that help meet sustainability goals.
That's exactly right. This is why the word sustainability has definitely been around for at least a decade. And it's why we've really struggled to pinpoint what that is exactly because of those nuances. And, you know, I know many companies and agricultural processors are looking at, you know, what's our overarching goal and how can we make this a portfolio approach where this sector of our business has this specific goal, this other sector has another goal, and the composite of all of those help us achieve that overarching goal. But it's really figuring out what those individual factors are. And I think the other thing that's really important for the greater audience to think about is, you know, we are great researchers and we're great scientists. And in a vacuum, we can say, this is what we need to do to decrease greenhouse gases or whatever that may be. But oftentimes, all of the parties that are part of implementing that specific, you know, practice are not always at the table. So while that practice may work perfectly in that closed environment, when we try to implement it at a farm level or at a corporate level, it doesn't work. And oftentimes it's like, oh, yeah, that specific process can be implemented year round. And we did in this closed environment, but we can't. And that's completely fine. That's research, but it's figuring out how those pieces come together. And it makes it a slow iterative process because this is a biological process. You can only raise one crop of corn a year. So, you know, you only have X amount of chances to test some of this stuff. So it does take time.
Sure. It is quite interesting, especially, you know, just between research and implementation. When you research something in a closed environment, the intention is to gain a better understanding of what sustainability means from a certain perspective, or how we can better reach some larger sustainability goals. But at the end of the day, a lot of farmers are, yes, interested in making those changes, interested in, say, rebuilding soil structure from the example you listed. But they also want to make sure that they don't lose the farm in the process, risking too much. So understanding the research, understanding the implementation, and, you know, not only that it's a slow process with the biology of it, but it's also a slow process in making sure that farmers can keep themselves fed.
Yes, that's a really great point. All of these sustainability practices come at a financial cost. And if we know that those input costs are going to be higher for the producer, we have to make sure that the price that they're receiving for their product is also increasing. And oftentimes those things are not matching up, which also creates not necessarily hesitancy. It's, I would say, financial hesitancy. If farmers are already barely breaking even, to adopt another practice on top of that already low margin or negative margin is just a really tall order at different points in time during the production process.
Yeah, if I'm as a consumer living paycheck to paycheck, I'm not going to be spending a lot of money at the local farmers market. It's the same concept. If a farmer is already having a, you know, breaking even or having to be careful with finances, it's tough to make the leap towards something that is better in the long run, perhaps, but won't keep you around for the long run financially. We started talking a little bit about the financial barriers to adopting new practices. Could you speak a little bit more about the barriers to adopting these practices from an agribusiness standpoint?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to hop back to the cover crop example because we just did a bunch of research on this. I had a wonderful graduate student who did this work. And what we did is we collected all of the sort of agricultural economic data for crop farms in Minnesota. And what we wanted to do is, often we hear cover crops described in the context of you plant them and then you have your livestock graze on it after you harvest the corn, and then it's an additional feedstuff. But the majority of southern Minnesota is crop-only operations with corn and soybeans. So we're like, how do they implement this without having a livestock source to come in and eat?
Next week, we'll talk about what growers are doing to help themselves.
They're really using it as some type of fertilizer.
And how they're building a network of knowledge, data, and resources to support each other in the journey to widespread adoption.
You know, $15 to $20 per acre.
Until next time.
To plant this cover crop. So that includes, you know, the cost of the seed, the time to plant it, and any additional, like, costs associated with that. Again, that's a ballpark. So the farmer has to figure out how they're going to find that extra $20 per acre. And if they're a 3,000-acre farm, odds are they're not going to do cover crops on all of their acreage. So what we did find was that it made sense for them to put cover crops on their marginal land. Because once they put the cover crops on that marginal land, it allowed them to help rebuild that soil structure. And it could increase the yield of their crop on that marginal land to some of their more productive land. So from an agribusiness perspective, at least as we're starting to figure out what works and doesn't in different climates, the assumption that you have to use cover crops on 100% of your acreage probably is not realistic from a financial perspective. But if 15% of your land is soil that needs to be rebuilt or it needs to be regenerative, this is a good way to do it. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy. And we all like to do that, right? We're like, plant this specific thing in this specific location. The other caveat is it takes about 3 to 5 years to see the benefits. You will potentially see decreased yields at the beginning of this endeavor, but then as you build out, we were able to see those benefits over time.